Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices that are facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Max. Coming up on the program, intensifying trade wars redraw the map as Africa fights for relevance in a fractured global economy. Gen Z fuels a car finance boom, but missed payments are flashing warning signs. Entry-level jobs get tougher to land as skill shortages refuse to ease. And when artificial intelligence breaks the system, the blame still stops with human beings. It's Tuesday, the 20th of January. Now, global trade is slowing, supply chains are fragmenting, and climate rules are fast becoming market gatekeepers. Now, as trade tensions rise and growth cools, Africa is facing a defining moment. Either adapt to a more complex global system or risk being left behind. And in that respect, I want to talk to Luz Maria de la Mora from the UN Trade and Development Unit to unpack where Africa stands right now in this shifting global trade order. Thank you very much for joining us. And maybe we could start with a very brief global overview. And let me ask you how unsettled the stage is right now because of all of the increasing geopolitical tensions that we seem to witness day by day.
Well, certainly we are seeing a lot of uncertainty and a lot of unpredictability in the global economic environment. And that obviously is not the kind of environment that investors need in order to be able to trigger economic growth. So what we're seeing is that global growth this year will keep more or less in the same level as last year at 2.6%. That's what we are seeing, that the global growth will remain subdued. Now, something important is that trade normally used to be an engine of economic activity and economic growth for countries. And trade has been, even though it's been growing, and we expect trade to grow probably in 2025 around 5-6%, there is still some slowdown in certain sectors, and we expect that to happen also. But we think that in South-South trade has some opportunities.
Well, let's talk about those opportunities in just a moment, but I'm interested to hear you use the word subdued. So maybe you could tell us how exposed then Africa is to this slowdown that we're likely to witness in 2026. Where's the vulnerability here?
Well, African economies, like other regions, are quite exposed to the global slowdown of the world economy. And there are a few areas. For example, the first I would say is that many countries in Africa rely heavily on commodities, like, for example, oil, gas, minerals, or agricultural products. And when global demand weakens or prices swing, these revenues take an immediate hit. A second area has to do with the fact that Africa's export markets are largely outside the continent. So when advanced economies or their markets slow down, the exports of Africa are also heavily impacted. So African export earnings could drop down. And a third one has to do with tighter global financial conditions that are making things tougher. We are seeing high interest rates. Even though they are coming down, interest rates for African countries are still very high, historically high, and that affects investment flow. So for many countries, they are already carrying high levels of debt, And repayment costs are now one of the biggest risks for their economic stability. So overall, I would say that the combination of commodity dependence, external demand pressure, and costly financing makes African economies sensitive to global headwinds.
So if there is that dependence then on external demand, as you suggest, do you think in any way African economies are becoming a little more resilient? Are we becoming perhaps better equipped to handle the headwinds that you outline?
Yes, definitely. We are seeing some bright spots for Africa. And I would say, on one hand, we are seeing an increase in trade and exports of Africa to developing countries, South-South trade. So it's not only the traditional export markets in the EU or the US, but it's also developing countries in Asia that are acquiring African products. And I would say that the Africa Continental Free Trade Area is really building. I mean, it's a new project, but it's a very important project where integration has proven to be a trigger for economic activity. What we need to take care of is the long-term perspective. Do not lose track and keep building on that framework for Africa.
I'm glad you mentioned the African Continental Free Trade Area. I guess the question, though, is whether it's moving fast enough to matter in this more fragmented global trading system that you've outlined.
It has to. I think the question is really a matter of implementing on time all of the commitments, because there are many commitments in the Africa Continental Free Trade Area that also are related to sub-regional integration schemes that already exist. I would say that the value of the Africa Continental Free Trade Area is that it sets a framework for the whole 53 countries that are part, and it sets a clear path for transparency, for tariff reduction, for NTM streamlining, and for making sure that Africa is one continent that is linked. And another thing that we see is that there's a need to build infrastructure. Connectivity is key to integrate Africa and to make sure that Africa can profit from the Africa Continental Free Trade Area.
It's interesting to read that services and digital trade are growing the fastest worldwide, yet Africa lags badly. What in that respect do you think is holding the continent back?
Well, I would say several things. First, Africa traditionally has been an exporter and producer of commodities and manufactures. Africa needs to make inroads in the services sector, which is already doing. And let me give you one example, has to do with, for example, digital services in the financing sector or the transition to renewable energy. There's a lot of investment that is happening, but needs to happen. So you need, on one hand, infrastructure, and on another hand, you also need to develop strategies on which services are key for the integration. Logistics, for example, telecommunications, roads, services for the business community. And then you also need to have people that are skilled. Services require different types of skills from the manufacturing sector. So you need to have a skilled workforce in Africa that can support the services sector, which is also essential to support the export value chain of African countries into the region. So I would say that Africa has promising areas of resilience, but also of opportunity in the services sector, not only to participate in international trade globally, but also to deepen the integration within Africa.
And that's where I am going to leave it with my thanks, Luz Maria de la Mora from UN Trade and Development. I do appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's credit landscape is shifting and shifting quickly. So-called Gen Z is now driving the vehicle finance boom. First-time buyers are taking on bigger loans over longer periods, and more consumers are relying on credit cards as financial shock absorbers. But behind the growth sits a more worrying trend, I think: rising delinquencies, tighter credit limits, and a high risk tilt in lending behavior. So at what point does smart credit expansion turn into a degree of systemic strain? I want to explore that in a little more detail with Aisha Hatia, who's Director of Research and Consulting at TransUnion. So Aisha, welcome to you. Gen Z then, as I've just said, driving new car finance, but with delinquencies rising, is this sustainable, do you think, or are we starting to see the formation of a credit bubble?
I think it's a little bit of both. We are seeing a bubble. We are seeing quite a strong growth in credit across many products, especially quarter on quarter, year on year. We've seen the growth coming in various products, and it is driven by Gen Zs. And a lot of these consumers are sort of new to the credit world. And I think what's becoming more and more important is the credit education that comes along with the inclusivity and the access that these new sort of credit consumers are having. So lenders are starting to have a responsibility of educating consumers not just about affordability and what they presumably can afford based on their income, but also understanding what it means to repay those loans, the consequences of missing payments on those loans, and really helping and to ensure that the credit is actually sustainable.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? Because long-term loans are stretching, if I read correctly, beyond 72 months. Surely we're setting up young consumers for long-term debt traps that they simply are not going to get out of until, you know, they're in their 30s and beyond.
I think it's not that simple specifically when it comes to vehicle and asset finance. We're seeing that stretch specifically in that space, and there's a lot more mechanics that go into that. So stretching it over more than 72 months does really come back to the actual vehicles that you're buying, and what we talk about is total cost of ownership. So yes, in one breath, we're saying it does help to a certain extent in terms of your monthly repayments and managing your repayments on a monthly basis, and gives you maybe some a little bit relief month to month. But it's, again, that education piece and understanding what that means for the total cost of ownership when it comes to owning that vehicles. Yes, there's additional interest that you're going to be paying over the longer term. So you as an individual consumer, you need to understand what that means for not just your short-term budget and your long-term budget. So there are pros and cons, but it's important to understand what they are and how that applies to you. So some people leverage it quite well, and unfortunately, some people are not quite sure what that means.
I absolutely understand your point about education, but if you have people that are either very aspirational and ambitious or simply desperate, Aisha, they're not going to pay any attention to the education, surely, as much as it comes down the pipeline.
Yeah, that I hear you, and that is quite unfortunate. We do find people, you know, using credit as a lifeline, and to your point, you know, some of the consequences or understanding those consequences goes out the window, and that is quite unfortunately what is happening in some of those, especially in the higher risk consumers, but. You know, at the end of the day, the knowledge is power. We need to make sure that consumers are entrenched with that understanding of credit and how it works and the implications it has on them.
Often, though, the ball is in the court of the lenders. Subprime borrowers now dominate new credit card originations. We've got to ask the question why lenders then are leaning into higher risk when, as we've mentioned, delinquency is rising.
So again, it's a balance, right? So at the end of the day, consumers do need access to credit. We need to be able to support them. Lenders do need to be able to support them. What we are seeing lenders doing is actually lowering that exposure. So even though the volume of credit cards is going up, we find that the value of those loans are declining. So allowing consumers to get the exposure, but trying to manage that or limiting that overextension upfront. We also acknowledge that, again, a lot of these consumers are new to credit, and they're looking for that opportunity to start getting into the credit market and building the financial sort of portfolios. And so by default, they also end up in this higher risk category that we find themselves. And so we have to give them that opportunity. And by trying to limit that exposure, lenders are reducing those limits.
But there is the argument that lenders are often chasing volume at the expense of prudence.
It's always going to be a balancing game. You know, most of these things are unpredictable by nature. And lenders have to find a way to manage that exposure as well as consider inclusion.
Aisha, what is most worrying about the information or the studies that the TransUnion does is nearly a third of consumers are taking new credit, if I understand this correctly, to pay old credit. That tells me that we are perilously close to a formal household debt stress threshold.
Yeah, we do know that South Africa does have a very high, debt to income ratio at the moment, and this behavior does point to cash flow pressures, and it does highlight that there is risk of debt cycling, especially if income growth doesn't improve, and a lot of that is unpredictable for consumers as well.
I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for a very honest and I also think a very worrying picture. Aisha Hatia, Director of Research and Consulting at TransUnion. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's job market is sending, I think, mixed signals. While demand remains strong in specialist fields like healthcare, finance, information technology, competition for entry-level and lower-skilled roles is intensifying, I'm told, and sharply. Now, there's new data from PNET that suggests the divide between opportunity and access is widening. So let's discuss what the numbers really say about work, skills, and prospects in 2026. And with me is Paul Byrne. He's been on the program with us before, Head of Insights and Customer Success at PNET. Paul, a very warm welcome. Your data shows fierce competition for lower skilled roles. A demand problem or a structural oversupply of labor? Which is it?
I think it's a bit of a combination of both there, Jeremy. If you think about it, what we really have got is a very different set of skills that are coming into the market, or the need for a very different set of skills that are coming to the market. We're just not producing enough of those at the moment, I think, is the most important problem. So that really speaks to the structural problem. And it does mean that those people that are looking for jobs right now need to really just rely on the base skills that they've got in order to be able to find those opportunities that do exist out there. And let me emphasize that there are jobs that are available for people that are coming into the market for the first time.
So graduates then would be entering the market potentially with the wrong or misaligned qualifications, but maybe there's also a dollop here of misguided or incorrect expectation.
I think so. We've got to be careful in terms of what it is that we're saying here, but I do think very importantly, the requirement in the job market is changing quite dramatically at the moment. And we've spoken before on your show about sort of the acceleration into jobs of the future. And we're starting to see that there's more and more of a demand for those type of skills now and not enough supply. So again, it talks to the structural problem in terms of, are we qualifying the right skill sets and providing the right education for the jobs that we need for these people into the future?
That's exactly the problem, isn't it? It's South Africa's education and training system that is misaligned and is simply not performing in pursuit of the goal that the country should be setting itself.
Correct, because if you look at where those opportunities exist and where that real demand is, it's across your roles like engineering, business and management, finance, IT roles, and medical and health. And those all really speak to jobs of the future. And specifically, if we're sort of breaking it down, across the IT space, as we've spoken about before, it's where we've seen the most demand. They are the most advertised opportunities across our platforms, and consistently we're seeing sort of software developers at the top of the list, but a growing need for your business analysts, your data analysts, your systems analysts, and so on. And we do need to get that right. Not to obviously forget mentioning sort of nurses and pharmacists and the importance of making sure that we've got the right skill sets qualified in South Africa to look after our growing population into the future.
This is not a new discussion. Why are we still having it? Why are we unable to get to grips with what the base problem is here, do you think?
My feeling is the lag time here. It takes time to get youngsters to understand what professions they want to go into. Then they've got to start that whole process of the education to get the qualification. And I think that we are really seeing this acceleration beyond the norm of what we normally would have seen in sort of past years, and hence that lag. We are going to need to play catch up. We need to put in programs that are going to accelerate these opportunities and really also focus on sort of an upcoming requirement. There's also a bit of a change in terms of mindset from organizations to say, let's look not necessarily just at the base qualifications that are needed for jobs, but how do we actually help people to upskill? Because there are skills that you can learn oneself. And specifically, if we focus in on the IT space and development, there's an opportunity for a large sort of case of self-taught, self-teaching there. And yet we still see amongst a lot of the employers that are advertising for jobs today that their prerequisite is a degree. And we're starting to say the shift is here, where we're seeing that degrees are important, but the skill base that people are bringing into the jobs is becoming even more important now, because they need to be able to hit the ground running in terms of what it is that they can deliver for the companies they're going to be working for.
Paul Byrne, you raised two important issues. One are programs to accelerate. The second is companies and the mindset change that they need to have. What kind of programs do we then need to start implementing in order to maybe jumpstart the process?
Jeremy, I think there is an onus on the private sector to start looking at what skills they need into the future. And again, I think it's very predictive in terms of where companies see themselves going. So setting the visions right and understanding that they've got that skill set is really, really important. But I think a very important conversation also comes down to how companies are recruiting and actually finding the right people. And I think there's a bigger responsibility on organizations to start promoting themselves better in terms of what it is that they can offer. Job seekers are becoming very specific about what they're looking for. It's a changed world. You know, it's no longer sort of I need to join a company where I'm going to work for the rest of my life or the foreseeable 10 years or whatever the case may be. People are wanting to move. They're wanting to find the company that's the right cultural fit for them, and vice versa. Companies are looking for the right culture fit in terms of the right type of talent. But again, I go back to the point in saying that organizations need to start really marketing themselves for what it is that they can offer us as job seekers to say, this is the reason why you want to come and work for us. And fundamentally, people are looking for probably three things. They're looking for purpose in what it is that they want to do as a career, and the companies that they want to work for need to be able to deliver that purpose. The companies need to show that there's a career progression and sort of an opportunity for learning. And whether or not that is in the form of the companies actually providing some kind of learning opportunity, or at least at the very least encouraging job seekers to go out and actually develop themselves, and in other words invest in themselves to learn on the job skills, is really important. Creating that opportunity is really important. And that third pillar that I speak to is the flexibility that we seem really to have adapted quite well to in the South African market for those jobs where people can have an element of flexibility, whether it be remote type work or hybrid type work specifically, I think is working particularly well in South Africa. Again, I make the point for those jobs that can sustain that. There are certain jobs where people just need to be in the office. But for some of the scarcer skills, and I go back to the likes of your software developers and your data analysts and some of your senior management roles, those are positions that can offer the opportunity of hybrid type work. And that's becoming of a lot of interest to job seekers looking for a new job in the market. So those three things, that progression, that purpose, and that flexibility are what companies need to be also looking at in terms of how they market those opportunities.
Paul, a lot of young people are rowing up the job stream right now in January, come February this year. If you were to look ahead, is there a single hard choice then that job seekers have got to make now if they either want to find that job or stay employable?
Jeremy, I think the most important choice that they make is a dedication to ongoing learning. So no matter where we find ourselves in our careers, whether we're starting in the workplace for the first time, we're entering as a graduate, or in actual fact, if we're seasoned employees and we're looking to stay employed and be able to add value, we need to understand what it is that we have to continue to do to progress ourselves. The world is changing so rapidly now that even just the advent of AI and the ability to use it correctly in the workplace is becoming an important skill. And we're starting to see in our numbers that more and more jobs have been advertised with that sort of almost prerequisite requirement of a basic understanding of AI as a tool set. How do I use AI to make me more effective in what it is that I'm doing?
Thank you very much indeed. In conversation there with Paul Byrne, Head of Insights and Customer Success at PNET. Paul, I always appreciate the conversation. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I don't need to tell you that artificial intelligence is racing into every corner of business, and telecoms no exception. But our next guest says there's one place you can't treat like an experiment: the systems that sell you data, that bill you every month and hold your personal details. Damien Burnett is a sales director at the telecom solutions company VASX, and he's arguing that in telecoms, you don't get to shrug and say, well, the AI did it when something goes wrong. So here's my question: where does AI genuinely help? Where does it actually become a liability? And what does humans in the loop actually mean when the stakes are money, privacy, and regulation? Damien, welcome. And I think this is an important discussion. For listeners, first of all, a business support system in plain English. What is it, and what parts of our daily phone life does it actually touch?
Great. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. Jeremy, a business support system and the coupled operational support system that you get in telcos, these are essentially the systems that keep the network running in the background. So the business side of things would be your business support systems, and that's your billing, customer accounts, the order management, payments, things like that. And the operational support systems, these are more the network type things, and also background events like provisioning of services, monitoring the actual network and things like that.
Yeah. And your argument is that a business support system is not, and I quote, an AI playground. So what's the realistic worst case scenario if a telco treats it like one?
Look, I mean, it depends. It depends on what goes wrong. When we say AI makes mistakes, it's not typically the AI that makes a mistake. The code is actually doing exactly what it was built to do. It just didn't have a human behind that code, putting it in. So when code is generated by AI, there are logical flaws, vulnerabilities that can creep in unnoticed. And I mean, the consequences could be anything from underbilling, overbilling, complete outages on the network. So subscribers being unable to make or receive calls. And then I think in the most severe cases, exposing sensitive subscriber data to third parties who would use that data with malicious intent.
So, Damien, what I'm hearing is that you're not anti-AI. It's anti-AI without guardrails. So are there non-negotiables that you would insist on before AI touches a BSS code?
Yes. So, look, I mean, there's definitely space for AI in all software development environments, including telco. But I think the main thing is when you're dealing with certain industries and certain departments like billing and CRM, and you're handling such sensitive data, it's important to keep humans in the loop. So, we need AI to suggest things, to automate things. So, for example, code. There's a lot of boilerplate code, which is the typical code that you would find in most software modules. You could have AI draft that for you, and then humans input the actual sensitive machinery and build in the actual logic of what happens. So for humans to review that code and understand it, I think that's the most important part, is for humans to actually understand what this code is doing.
Let me try and take a counterpoint here. I would suggest to you that telcos, though, often make billing errors, even though humans are involved. Why would AI make that better or worse?
Look, I mean, if billing software is already quite erroneous, even under human design, the situation would only get worse without visibility and understanding into what's going on. So, it just increases the avenues for risk to creep into systems like this.
So if something that's AI generated causes customer dissatisfaction or there's overcharging, how do you rectify it then? What's the recourse here?
Look, so typically there'd be a vendor system, and a vendor would be the ones who made use of the AI to build up these BSS platforms. So those BSS vendors are typically held to SLAs and contractual agreements with the service provider. But the more AI that is used in building up these systems, the longer it would take for these vendors to understand the problem and resolve it.
Damien, I love asking an accountability question. So when something breaks or a regulation is a problem or there is a mishandling of personal data, within the context of our conversation, then who carries the can? Is it the vendor? Is it the developer, the executive team, or maybe something that even falls in the regulator's lap?
Obviously, the regulator would hold the telco accountable for any incidents under their watch. Telcos are held to a series of very stringent guidelines and conditions. So they would most certainly be held liable by the regulator. If there were civil cases or litigation that were brought to the telco itself, depending on the contractual agreement with the vendor, some of these might be, these claims might be passed down to the vendor itself. But I think the important point here is that the AI provider, so your open AIs, your Anthropics, they would never feel the brunt of these outages. So definitely it goes without saying that they have to be used with caution.
So within the South African context, then, the telcos that you deal with, are they finding that balance between AI and humans in the loop? Or is there a sign that maybe some of them are moving too fast without the proper human oversight that you've recommended?
So I think AI in telco is still quite new. So I wouldn't say that there's a widespread adoption of, completely AI generated or let's say AI native platforms yet. But there are certainly players in the industry that have positioned themselves like that. In South Africa, there hasn't been much of an uptake yet. But, I think all companies are looking to see how they can optimize their operations and move faster and better and innovate better. So that time will come when operators are faced with that opportunity to maybe get something more affordably. But in the background, perhaps there was an overuse of AI.
So just in conclusion, a quick summary then, where should AI sit in the process right now and where must humans remain firmly in control?
So I think the main thing is to be using it for augmentation. One of the big questions would be, can the people on my team understand why this platform made a certain decision? If you can't clearly explain how the system works or why it made a decision, it means you've definitely overused the AI and you're at risk. So let AI handle the repetitive tasks and always have humans step in at the approval junctures to review, understand, and approve.
I suspect that advice extends way beyond the telco sector as well. Damien Burnett, thank you very much indeed. Fascinating conversation. I appreciate your time. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.